loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk about the vote this week in the Senate to authorize a defense budget, so-called defense budget, the war budget, of $716 billion. That's an $82 billion increase over last year. It passed 85-10 with support from politicians like former vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine, Chuck Schumer, and liberal favorite Cory Booker. Part of the Pentagon budget will actually go to incarcerate detained children and their parents. We talk through the issues of the defense spending with Dan Kovalik and Kevin Zeese. And then we continue our weekly look at political races around the country in the run-up to the midterm elections in November. This week was primary week. We're going to take a look at the results and what they mean for the upcoming elections.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, as demonstrations continue across the country, including the occupation in Portland, Oregon, of an ICE facility, controversy continues to swirl over the fate of detained families and asylum seekers. Will the children really be reunited with their parents? Is the Trump administration considering even more draconian anti-immigrant measures? Next, in a 5-4 decision today, the Supreme Court ruled that police need a warrant to access cell phone location data. We'll talk about what this means for the fight against mass surveillance and police misconduct. Then U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley branded as, quote, patently ridiculous, misleading, and politically motivated, unquote, a U.N. report condemning entrenched poverty in the United States. She added that the U.N. should be focused on countries like Rwanda and Burundi instead. And then global oil prices were sharply lower on Thursday and sharply higher on Friday as OPEC ministers moved toward an agreement to keep production low. Iran and Venezuela had argued for lower output to keep prices high. And finally, again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. And in other headlines, the House of Representatives passed a bipartisan bill aimed at addressing the opioid crisis today by a vote of 396-14. The bill includes provisions aimed at increasing access to addiction treatment and encouraging doctors to prescribe non-opioid painkillers. Critics, however, say that the bill fails to appropriate anywhere near the necessary resources to meet the scope of the problem. The Greek government secured an historic green light from the finance ministers of the Eurozone to return to the financial markets. The move comes ahead of the expected exit of Greece from its third bailout program on August 20th. Greece has been compelled by the Troika, the European Commission, European Central Bank, and International Monetary Fund, to implement harsh austerity measures for nearly a decade. In a string of recent bad news for Paul Manafort, U.S. District Court Judge Amy Berman Jackson rejected today Manafort's request to dismiss his money laundering charge, as well as dismissing a forfeiture claim on his properties. Manafort's lawyers argued that his conduct did not violate the law due to their reading of the law, and the federal judge ruled that their argument was, quote, inconsistent with the text of the statute. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton is visiting Moscow today and will meet with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. This could mean a diplomatic meeting sometime soon between President Putin and President Trump, something Trump has expressed interest in. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the Pentagon and the Pentagon budget. The Senate voted this week 85-10 to give the Pentagon a budget of $716 billion for fiscal year 2019. That's an increase of $82 billion from last year. Economists warn that such a major budget increase is untenable over the long term because of the growing size of the U.S. federal deficit. And Congress doesn't seem to care about the optics of such a vote in the middle of the immigration crisis, despite the fact that it's the U.S.-supported coups in Latin America that have been a big contributing factor to immigration. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. Dan is a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of The Plot to Attack Iran, amongst other works. And we're joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. Kevin is the co-coordinator of PopularResistance.org. You can check out his work and the work of others at popularresistance.org. Dan and Kevin, welcome back.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Dan, I'm starting to look at headlines this morning that indicate that the U.S. military budget is getting close to that $1 trillion number. Of course, if you look at all the ways that defense spending, so-called military spending, is encapsulated in the budget, because some of it's not in the DOD, Department of Defense budget, it's almost already at $1 trillion, or perhaps it's even gone over it. But when we're talking about $1 trillion, I'm talking about the actual official Pentagon budget. And this is at a time when the country is, quote, at peace. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's quite incredible. And meanwhile, of course, at the same time they're increasing the military budget, the Republican-led House is aggressively trying to cut nearly every form of social safety net we have in this country, claiming we don't have the money to take care of our poor and take care of our elderly and even take care of our veterans. This should be a major issue for the American people, how we are prioritizing our spending, and yet it isn't the main issue that you hear most of the time.
You know, I'm looking at some of the Democrats who voted to back the Republicans and back Trump and back the Pentagon budget in this massive $82 billion increase. These are some of the same voices we've been hearing all week long expressing their complete moral outrage about the Trump administration's position on immigration. Chuck Schumer, for instance, voted yes. Of course he voted yes. He's the leader of the Democrats. Just earlier this week, he said, anyone who believes this Republican Congress is capable of addressing this issue, immigration, is kidding themselves. The president can end this crisis with the flick of his pen, and he needs to do so now. And then like 3 days later, like, yeah, let's support Trump in the defense budget, so-called. And now we know, Kevin Zeese, that the Pentagon is preparing large numbers of military installations to house migrants, refugee, asylum seekers, perhaps as many as 20,000. So on one day, Chuck Schumer says, this is terrible. This is immoral. And the next day he votes yes to increase the defense budget so that the military can set up little camps for those people who have been treated so unfairly, according to him, by Donald Trump. It's really sort of a breathtaking level of hypocrisy.
Yeah, you know, the immigrants essentially are the scapegoat for mismanagement of the U.S. economy and U.S. foreign policy. When you look at corporate trade agreements and their negative impact in Latin America and South America, when you look at the regime change efforts, which we can see having their impact now in Nicaragua, we saw it in Venezuela, the disruption and violence that comes with millions of dollars of U.S. funding for creating opposition to left governments that are trying to provide social services. Look at the drug war and the violence that has caused in Mexico. And look at climate change, which is a major cause of immigration. All these issues are bipartisan failures. And rather than face up to those failures, they scapegoat immigrants. And both parties do it. President Obama is still the record deporter-in-chief. For annual record number of deportations, Trump has to triple his numbers to catch up to Obama's best year. He also imprisoned families and did separate children from families. And then you have Trump just carrying that same agenda forward. And when Obama was doing it, the Democrats were silent. They, you know, deporter-in-chief, go ahead. When Trump does it, the Republicans are silent. So we're not facing up to the real issues. Immigrants are the scapegoat. Let's face up to putting in place trade policies that are benefiting the people and the planet, ending interventions that cause militarism and regime change, facing up to the drug crisis, which is really U.S. drug consumption and the drug war creates abroad. So until we face the underlying causes, the immigrants will continue to be abused and mistreated, and we'll all be really, people will be upset about it. But unfortunately, the story will continue until the foundation has changed.
Dan Kovalik, one of the things that has me more upset, I think, than anything else is the size of the majority on this vote in the Senate, 85 to 10, with five not voting. You know, we're supposed to accept the idea, the notion that the Democrats are the opposition party in this country. And when it comes to the big issues, this was the largest budget increase for the Pentagon in American history. It's the largest budget for the Pentagon in American history. We're approaching now $1 trillion as an annual budget for the Pentagon. And there's very little oversight. You've got a staff of a couple of dozen on the oversight committees on each side, so that it's impossible, literally impossible, to oversee a budget of this size and a staff of the size of DOD. Why is it that we don't really have an opposition party on defense matters? Is it that the Democrats are afraid of being labeled again as weak on defense?
I actually think it's more systemic than that. I think, first of all, you have major portions of the economy that depend on defense spending, and you have many Congress people who have important, you know, military bases for their economies and their communities, so they need that for votes. You know, it goes back to what Eisenhower talked about in terms of the military-industrial complex, which was tiny compared to what it is now. We have built a nation around the military, around war, and there doesn't seem to be any voices trying to build a peace economy, essentially. And so the order of the day is to continue to spend money on war, and therefore you need wars to fuel it. And that's why you see the Democrats, for example, like Schumer, upset that maybe peace will break out with Korea because it's not good for business. By the way, I saw a story where the Pentagon can't account for like $21 trillion or something of spending.
And I'm seeing that on social media where it's the Pentagon can't account for $21 trillion. Yes, that's not a typo.
So, you know, they're basically, you know, if any other agency of the government was wasting money like that, you would hear about it, and you would hear for calls for reforms and calls for people to be fired. And yet when it's the Defense Department, they can, you know, get away with murder.
One of the things that's very disturbing to me, too, is that as a matter of course, the Pentagon does not have either internal or external audits. Defense Logistics Agency a year ago did an audit, and it was a novel idea. And they found that there were hundreds of millions of dollars missing, just missing, gone, that they couldn't account for. Imagine, I mean, DLA is...
And it's not little, buried in the ground, by the way.
No, it's not buried in the ground in plastic wrapping. DLA is a very small agency within DOD. Imagine DOD as a whole. It's got to be, over the course of the decades, it's got to be trillions of dollars that just is unaccounted for.
And who knows what kind of items are being done around the world, what kind of actions are being taken around the world with that, what comes as slush fund, that unaccountable money.
That's right, that we don't know about, that would probably be deemed classified.
I mean, it's not just as classified, it's unaudible, it's mismanaged. No one even knows. There are probably sections of the Pentagon that take this money and use it for their own purposes. You don't need an Iran-Contra anymore. You don't need that scandal. You can just use the slush fund, the hidden money that's just wasted.
The United States now will spend almost $1 trillion this year. Well, not quite, but we're getting there. Just for our audience to understand, I'm looking at some 2016 figures. These are 2 years old. They were actually produced a year ago. And at that time, the United States accounted for 36% of all, quote, defense, let's call it military war spending in the world. The next largest military spending was from China. China spent one-third. That's one-third that the amount the United States spent. You know how much Russia spent? You know, Russia is on the march. We hear all that. We did an earlier segment where Putin, the headline was Putin has undermined America's moral authority. We're trying to figure out exactly how that happened. But Russia's military budget is less than one-tenth the size of the U.S. defense budget. And the fourth largest military is Saudi Arabia, which is the American military budget, too, because they get all their weapons from the Pentagon and from American weapons manufacturers. That's Saudi Arabia has almost the same defense budget as Russia. Militarism, Dan Kovalik, is a thing for the world right now, but it's really a made in the USA thing.
Yes, we're the biggest arms supplier in the world, as you know. If you look at the list of the highest spending, you know, countries on the military, most are U.S. allies, and again, most get their weapons from us in any case. Yeah, the business of, you know, they used to say the business of America is business. Now the business of America is war. And that is not an exaggeration. And again, when you spend that kind of money on the military, you got to use it. You know, every when you're a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And so every issue that we have in the world, we apply policies of war against. And it is a quite frightening situation. And what is most frightening is not only are the Democrats very much in line with that policy, you see very little foment amongst the general population on this issue, even amongst those who hate Trump.
Yeah, why is that?
Well, no, I mean, I think, first of all, we've been primed so well by presidents like Obama. You know, people essentially disarmed in terms of protest under Obama, including when he destroyed countries like Libya and Syria. And I think people got used to the idea, you know, they essentially over time get used to the idea that, oh, we're going to fight four or five or seven wars at a time. And when someone like Trump comes into power, even though they don't like him, he's more or less just continuing what Obama was doing anyway. And I think, therefore, that sort of complacency continues over.
You know, I was also looking at some other defense budget numbers, and I think they're so revealing because how much a country spends on weapons and war says a lot about what its priorities are, and especially what proportion of the national budget, the discretionary part of the budget, goes for defense spending or for the interest for lending so as to finance or fund earlier military expenditures or earlier military wars. I mean, the U.S. spent trillions on the Iraq invasion, trillions on Afghanistan. It looks now that the United States spends about 50%, that would be 50 cents out of every dollar of discretionary funding, on military items or on the interest payment for earlier military spending. 50 cents out of every dollar. And then the government is always talking about how can we fix Social Security? How can we fix Medicare? How can we fix Medicaid? How come these funds are going to be going bankrupt and running out of running out of money? But there's never, ever, ever any discussion about the Pentagon running out of money.
Well, let me add something to that before our guests answer. I remember sitting in a briefing at the CIA in 1991, right? So this is just as we're going to attack Iraq and try to push them out of Kuwait. And I remember President George H.W. Bush asking one of the senior analysts, what is this costing us? And the analyst said, it's costing us $1 million a day to be in the Gulf. And the president was stunned. He couldn't believe we were spending that much money. Well, that's quite quaint now to spend $1 million a day. It's got to be 100 times that now. And we don't bat an eye over it.
You know, it's revealing, Brian, but it's also deceptive. First off, the phrase defense budget. It's not defense. The U.S. has never been attacked by another country since World War II, and it's really an offensive military, and so it's really a military budget. And it's over a trillion. It's been over a trillion for a while. When you add the Energy Department and the nuclear weapons, and that's been getting a big increase in recent budgets, and now it's 60%. I'm talking about with the Trump era increases, we're beyond the 50% era. Now we're into the 60% of discretionary spending is going to military, and add to the military, not just the nuclear, add to the military the money spent on intelligence. It's really in the military intelligence budget, because the intelligence budget is now part of that.
And that budget is secret, right?
Parts of it is. Parts of it are. And then the State Department has become a military tool as well. You know, we're not a diplomatic-based foreign policy. We're a militarist-based foreign policy. The State Department plays that role. So we are way over a trillion. We've been over a trillion for years. We're way over a trillion now, but we deceive and try it. Why do people accept it? The military weapons manufacturers spread their work out throughout the country. Every congressional district has military weapons jobs in them. Every university, many universities, are getting large amounts of research money. Johns Hopkins in my town is the largest recipient of military research contracts. So you see across the country, elected officials have to respond to the reality that the military is a big part of their local economy. We've been doing this since the Eisenhower era. It's been a constantly building process and spreading out process. The military economy is deep. And why are people not fighting back? The anti-war movement was doing a lot of great work in the Bush era. Obama ran as a peace president. He defeated Hillary in the primaries advocating against the Iraq war while she was for it. So the peace president gets elected. The peace movement disappears, especially the black peace movement, which was a key part of the anti-war movement. And now is being rebuilt by Ajamu Baraka and the Black Alliance for Peace. But we have to rebuild from that Obama era. And Trump is taking the language. He uses the language of non-intervention. America first, come home, you know, and, you know, make America great again. Focus on rebuilding and non-intervening. So his language is also non-intervention. It's interesting that Obama and Trump got elected using that kind of language. It shows there's more of an anti-war feeling in the public than we recognize. And so I think you can see Bernie Sanders moving much more in the direction of opposition to war since he's been running for national office. So there's more there than we realize. We have more power than we realize. We just have to focus it better.
You know, that's an interesting point. When you look at who voted no, again, the vote was 85-10 for this basic looting of the national treasury for war contractors. Gillibrand, Democrat, New York, voted no. Harris, Democrat, California, voted no. Sanders, Vermont, voted no. Warren, Massachusetts, voted no. What do those four people have in common?
They're all running for president.
Indeed. And that's what, and Kevin's right. I mean, look at Trump again. Let's just reiterate. Trump is hated by so many people. He has below 50% in all approval ratings, but his Korea initiative, his meeting with Kim Jong-un, 55% approval rating. You're right. I mean, it looks like and is that America is a warfare state. It's not a welfare state. It's a warfare state. That's where its money goes. But actually, the people in the United States don't want war because no people really want war. And one out of every two Americans is either, and this is during the economic expansion, doing so poorly that they can't make ends meet. They're either in or near poverty, according to official statistics. People don't want their money spent for high-tech weapons that don't create, in addition to what they do to people, those are not really big job-producing kinds of industries. It's very capital-intensive, not labor-intensive. So there's Dan Kovalik, the basis is there on this issue of militarism to mobilize people, even though it's a hard slog. And it's not just because of the politicians, also the corporate-owned media, just as a matter of everyday reporting, it functions really as an echo chamber for the propaganda of the Pentagon.
Well, yes, and so does the entertainment industry. I mean, you have so many films that glorify the military and glorify war of one type or another, and of course, video games as well, which almost all revolve around some sort of violence, but many times even war type of violence. And so we've been very much lulled into accepting this. But I agree with you that people do, I think, at their core understand that this is not right, that, again, we have roads we need to fix, we have bridges we have to fix. You know, that this country, with all the resources it has, should be so much better than it is. And yet we've so prioritized spending money on destruction rather than creation. I think people do understand that, and I do think there are seeds there for building a peace movement.
I'm looking at another headline just to stay on the issue of the media. It's really, we talked about this too, John. As North Korea danger recedes ever so slightly, renewed Russian threat looms. That's the front page. That was the front page of Yahoo. Okay, so the North Korea danger. Well, what exactly is that? North Korea's defense budget is about $6.8 billion, about the size of the New York City Police Department budget. Russia, as we said, has one-tenth the amount of defense spending. Really, and Kevin's right, it's more than a trillion. It's really like about 6 or 7% of what the U.S. spends. And if you include the NATO budget, we're talking about 3 or 4% of what Russia spends compared to the U.S. and NATO. They're not threatening anybody, but nonetheless, Kevin, we have these kind of headlines that tell Americans North Korea was a threat, it's receding, but Russia's right there. There always has to be a threat.
And Putin is actually cutting their military budget. He's reprioritizing building the economy, which, of course, with U.S. sanctions, which is really part of the U.S. militarism, it's always been the U.S. way of war to starve your opponent economically, food-wise, you know, and of their basic resources before you attack them. Putin is not a threat. He's doing the opposite. He's going the other direction. And his actions in Ukraine was a defensive action against a U.S. coup to protect the people in Crimea and eastern Ukraine when the new government was threatening Russian speakers. Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union until Khrushchev. So there's a lot of Russian speakers. Syria, same thing. It was a defensive action against U.S. intervention, U.S. attempt at a violent regime change, creating a war, funding militants, often from out of Syria, to cause trouble and cause violence in Syria. So their role, they were called in by the Syrian government, and they also want to protect their small military base that's in Syria. So he's been defensive against the United States. So a lot of what we're told here, and I'd say North Korea was also defensive. I remember the U.S. had been doing massive war exercises on the pretending to attack North Korea, not just with conventional weapons, but with nuclear weapons, and not just attacks of the landmass, but also pretend. How do you assassinate the political leadership? We had our military working on that as well. So what are they going to do, this little country, when the U.S. has tens of thousands of troops on their border and is doing these war games? Of course they're going to do something to defend themselves. And they put their money into developing long-range missiles and nuclear weapons in order to not end up like Libya. Not end up like Gaddafi. What are they going to do? They have to defend themselves.
And John, I just saw a headline this morning. The U.S. has created another military base in Syria, around the town of Manbij. Yeah, so the U.S. can just go into any country.
Without anybody's permission.
And yeah, let's have another military base. And guess what? We, the American people, we can be paying for these military bases that are, in the case of Syria, just a fundamental violation of international law and an act of aggression. Anyway, we're out of time. We have been joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. Dan is a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of The Plot to Attack Iran, amongst other works. We've also been joined from Baltimore by attorney Kevin Zeese. Kevin is the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can check out his work and the work of others at Popular Resistance at popularresistance.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Again today we take a look at political races around the country in the run-up to midterm elections in November. This week saw developments all around America as even more races tighten up. We're joined in the studio by Jacqueline and Abdus Lukman. They're the co-editors-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey, good to be here.
My favorite segment of the week.
It's ours,
oh,
too.
Wow. Ours, too.
So we can pack in as much information as we possibly can. I'm going to start
off the bat.
Politico had a very interesting article this week entitled Shrinking Map Boosts Democrats in Battle for the Senate. There were a lot of polls that came out this week, and funny thing is that they were state polls and they were polls specific to individual congressional races. And so they didn't get much press, if they got any at all. Well, they're actually very important. And what this article says is that these polls are telling us that there are several endangered Democrats who are actually no longer endangered. And it's because things are beginning to turn around state by state for them. So they're saying Ohio is now solidly Democrat, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And so what that's going to do for the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee is allow them to transfer money that they otherwise would have spent in those races, especially on advertising, which is quite expensive, to races in places like Indiana and Florida. And Nevada. Now, interestingly enough, it goes on to say, and why they buried the lead like this at the end of the article is beyond me. But they go on to say that privately, Republicans will tell you that West Virginia is a safe Democratic seat too,
mm-hmm.
and Montana is probably safe too.
Right.
So the bottom line here, and it's not just Chuck Schumer saying it because he's gratuitous, he's paid to say things like this, but there are experts who are saying that not only are the Democrats doing well in these very difficult re-election races, they're projecting that the Democrats could actually win back the Senate this year.
Yeah. I mean, a few weeks ago, we didn't think that was possible.
No. But where do you see that happening? Are you thinking about places like Nevada and Missouri, or where do we pick up? I say we like I'm still a Democrat. Tennessee. Where do the Democrats pick up these seats?
I do think that Florida is, believe it or not, I think Florida is possible if they can't shift their resources to really attack this race in Florida. They've got a chance.
Well, you remember we talked about that last week, that there were polls showing that Nelson is in deep trouble in Florida, and that Governor Scott may pull the thing out. But Governor Scott, the guy's been governor for 8 years, and he still can't hit 50% in this race.
That's true. And we have to continue to look at the wider political landscape of what's going on in Trump world. Right. And we can't discount that the daily waves of bizarre Trumpism is not affecting or is affecting these state races, because they are. And these things are happening so fast that it's hard to keep on top of it. But the tide is changing for the Republicans. And the fact that, like you said, John, they buried that lead
at the
very end, where the Republicans are admitting, yeah, these states, we're not going to be able to overcome the Democratic lead in these states, because these Republicans can't counter what Trump is doing. They have no answer. They can't excuse it.
Now, the stars are going to have to align for the Democrats. They're going to have to hold all of these seats, and then they're going to have to win in Missouri, in Nevada, and in Tennessee. Or they could actually lose. Well, no, they can't, because Missouri is Claire McCaskill. Then to break a 50-50 tie, they would also have to win Arizona, which is tough.
Yeah, but also we have to understand, too, that even though the prospects look good, now going down to Florida is interesting, because, John, you mentioned about the Democrats having all this money and that they can focus more resources on Florida. But Scott got a lot of money, too.
Yeah, a bottomless pit of money.
Yes, yes.
That's true.
And in his own pockets.
Exactly. And also, we have to understand that the Democrats have to really play their game very carefully here, because all it would take is two incumbents to lose, and then they could forget the majority.
That's true.
That's it.
Yeah.
It. You're right.
This isn't like an overwhelming, crashing blue wave that's just going to obliterate.
No, no.
This is...
They can't make a mistake here.
Exactly.
No, you're exactly right.
Exactly.
They can't make a mistake.
Everything has to be perfect.
That's right.
For them to pull this off.
Not stranger things have happened.
Well, you remember, I don't know if you remember, but I certainly remember in 1978, the stars aligned like this for the Republicans. The Democrats thought there was no possible way that they could lose. I forget what it was. It was like 12 Senate seats. And it happened. 78 and then in 80. And the Senate flipped for the first time since the Eisenhower administration.
Right, right.
So anything can happen.
It'll be interesting to watch. That's for sure.
Another thing that I think has been fascinating to watch is this very, very odd congressional Republican primary on Staten Island.
Oh.
What a crazy... You've got two Republicans running against each other, the incumbent representative and a former representative. I should say his name is Dan Donovan. And then Michael Grimm, who not only was defeated, but actually then went to prison for corruption. He also got himself in trouble when he was still in the House for beating the daylights out of a reporter. Well, he wants his seat back, and he's ignoring Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment, thou shalt not run against a Republican incumbent. Well, he made an accusation this week that is so stunning that if it's true, it necessitates a Justice Department investigation and a very serious criminal prosecution. What he said was that the current congressman, Donovan, told him privately that he would ask President Trump to pardon Grimm if Grimm dropped out of the race.
Right.
That's a crime.
That is absolutely a crime.
It's a felony. You can't do that. Do you think that there's anything to that? I mean, none of us obviously have any inside information, but this is stunning. And to come right out and say it makes me think that that's just a bridge too far to make up. There has to be something to it.
Yeah, I think, and the way Politico reported it, there is something to it. Although Donovan didn't admit that he gave this offer to Grimm as a concession for him not running against him. He said that he talked to the Trump administration and just gave Grimm's information to the Trump administration, and somebody in the Trump administration told him, "Oh no, stop! You have to send this to the Justice Department."
Right.
Well, of course he's going to say that.
Of course
he's going to say.
Right.
But the fact that he didn't deny that he had this conversation about possibly pardoning Grimm is, I think that's very telling. I think that's bad enough, and that itself might warrant an investigation. Because you notice the third of the four parties in this mess, Guy Molinari.
Exactly.
He's not saying anything.
Exactly. And he's in the middle of this.
He's in the middle of this. That's right.
And here's what Donovan said, and I actually laughed out loud when I read it. He says, "The guy is a confessed liar. My opponent is trying to interpret that I think he deserves a pardon, but I was doing a favor for someone who used to be a friend of mine." He was referring to Guy Molinari, a former Republican congressman from Staten Island who was close to both Donovan and Grimm, at least until this campaign when he sided with Grimm.
That's right.
Well,
that's
he's
right.
like the only Republican who has sided with Grimm, because the entire GOP establishment has jumped in with Donovan, including the president.
That's right.
But this is an odd district. This is a district that historically has not had problems with representatives who have gotten into legal or ethical trouble. It's also kind of a moderately Republican district, but Grimm is coming out as more Trump than Trump. And Donovan is saying, well, I have Trump's endorsement, but I'm a lot more moderate than Trump.
Right. And then the sticky part of this is, if the other sticky part of this is, that Grimm is actually still popular.
Well, you because
crazy.
Well, just crazy popular.
But that's Staten Island.
But that's
exactly
what I was going to say. I mean, Grimm going to prison was actually points added to his reputation in Staten
right.
Island.
He went to prison and didn't talk.
Right. And number two, this is the thing that I think is very interesting, because the political article used the word incestuous.
Yes.
And describing the politics in that area. Now, we have to look at Trump, and we have to look that Trump comes from that area. Trump's politics, in my view, even though he wasn't a politician in New York, but Trump learned a lot about the political culture. And he brought that political incestuous culture to Washington.
From New York City to Washington.
Absolutely. Yes,
he did.
Yep.
So check this out. It says here, Grimm, who remains popular in Staten Island, was beating Donovan handily in a New York 1 Siena College poll. If Grimm were to defeat Donovan and go on to triumph in November, it would represent a spectacular comeback. And thanks to a Supreme Court ruling in the 1960s, the House would be forced to seat Grimm despite his felony record.
That's right.
And so they have to hold their nose and do it.
They have to hold the Republicans would have to hold their nose and do it. But the voters of Staten Island, they love this comeback story. They love this tough guy, you know, the smash mouth New York politics,
yes.
tough guy coming from behind, seemed to be beaten, coming back and winning it all. They love
and
this.
And at the same time, having the illusion of being an outsider, because I mean,
right.
he did time, he came out, you
exactly.
know.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know.
And now the people that you fell on your sword for, that's how some people look at it.
Right.
Now they're trying to push you back on the outside. Yeah. I think this spells a lot of bad news for Donovan, especially since Molinari coming out as saying anything in support of him. And of course, you know, Donald Trump isn't going to, so.
Yep. No, not at all. I want to finish it with this. Because I think this is just fantastic, too. As you said a few minutes ago, Jackie, Donovan is not denying that this conversation took place. And so when he was challenged by Grimm, Grimm said, so you hugged me, you kissed me, you even had a piece of paper and said, I spoke to Trump's staff. So you weren't trying to help me? Grimm asked Donovan. Donovan replied, no. I just gave you the pardon office. I'll let them decide.
Grimm responded, "Danny, you look like a fool right now."
That's something right out of like The Godfather Part 4.
I was thinking The Godfather when he said, "Fredo, I knew it was you."
Right. Yeah.
And
right,
he gave him the kiss.
Exactly. You broke my heart, Broke my heart.
Good heavens.
Politics couldn't be more fun right now, I don't think.
I'm a big fan of the Cook Political Report, although apparently now you have to pay for it to read the articles.
they're cashing in on their popularity.
Yep, they are. But there was a lot about individual races. And, you know, the polls on this so-called blue wave have been going back and forth and back and forth the last few months, where because of gerrymandering, the experts are telling us that instead of a generic Democrat versus Republican poll with the Democrats winning 9% that they can take back the House, because of gerrymandering, they're saying now that the Democrats have to win 13% in this generic poll over the Republicans to win back the House. Well, that was possible, then it was not possible, and now it's possible again because these races are really starting to tighten up. Now, of course, we're only in June. We have to get all the way to November, so anything, literally anything can happen between now and June. But there were a couple of races that I think are really important that we ought to look at. First one is Virginia's 10th District. This is mostly Loudoun County, a little bit of Fairfax, a little bit of Prince William, and this is Barbara Comstock. Well, they just had a primary there last week, and a female Democratic state senator who really was the strongest candidate and the best at fundraising, won the primary for the Democrats. So Comstock has been placed by the Cook Political Report as the single most endangered Republican in the House of Representatives. Loudoun County is the wealthiest county in America. It is highly educated. It has an increasingly large Hispanic population. And this may be where it finally flips blue. What do you think of that, Abdus?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that you described Northern Virginia that way. Virginians right. usually describe Northern Virginia as the other Virginia, you know? So, right. Yeah. But I think that I do believe that they have it correct, that Cook has it correct. Comstock is vulnerable. Also, with the change of demographics with the Hispanic population, is the fact that in the recent presidential elections and other elections, Northern Virginia has been voting progressive.
And in fact, that district went for Hillary Clinton.
Exactly. And Obama before that.
That's right.
Yep.
That's right.
So I kind of agree with the Cook thing on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially since I think there was a facility somewhere in Northern Virginia, somewhere, I think, where some of the separated children are going to be, separated immigrant uh-huh. children yes. are going to be housed. Comstock can't answer for that. Now, I'm not sure
boy.
If it's in their district. But there is no state that is going to house any of these children or families from this latest immigrant crisis and that's a whole nother discussion by itself. But there is no state that is involved in housing any of these people at all that the Republicans have an answer for that the voters will accept. They just don't. And we're not talking about Trump's base, because of course they're going to vote for Trump. But people who might have been seeing, well, you know, Trump is not so bad. He's meeting his campaign promises. He is putting people who might have been on the fence. This latest controversy with Trump, the Republicans have no answer for this. Comstock has no answer for this.
You know, when you've got Republican members of Congress calling for the resignation of the Republican Secretary of Homeland Security, calling for the resignation of a senior advisor to the president, and really just jumping over the side of the ship, you know you're in trouble. Or at least they recognize that they're in trouble. There's nothing they can do about it because these policies are dragging them down with them. And so the only thing they can do is to try to separate themselves early enough. Like I say, we're in late June, but early enough that they could at least try to stake out some kind of an independent position.
Yes, and this particular race, Comstock is also particularly vulnerable because of who her challenger is, MJ Weston. who is, she's an Afghanistan veteran.
Yeah, she's a decorated veteran.
She has received a Purple Heart and a Distinguished Flying Cross. Her helicopter was shot down while she was fighting the Taliban.
Oh, God. You can't make a better story. I mean,
she's a bona fide hero.
Yes. So that appeals to the war hero, stand with our vets contingent of the Republican Party.
And imagine how many Pentagon employees or military retirees live in that district.
A whole lot.
It's got to be.
So Comstock really, she's going to have the fight of her life on this one. And I actually think she's going to lose.
I agree.
I believe. I think it's going to be, I don't think it's going to be a landslide, but I do think she is going to lose.
I agree with you. And I think, honestly, it's no reflection on Barbara Comstock.
No.
I think, as Abdus pointed out, these are demographic changes. There's nothing Barbara Comstock can do about that.
No, not at all.
And it's the unpopularity in Northern Virginia of Donald Trump.
Yes.
Let's turn to Kentucky. Kentucky's 6th district. This has been a Republican district since Reconstruction, right? I mean, it's always been Republican. It's a hillbilly district. Yeah. They like, you know, church on Sunday and
bluegrass.
And bluegrass. Hey. Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
I'm a transplanted hillbilly from Southern Virginia.
Well, the Republican congressman there, Barr, has been safely reelected a half a dozen times.
Right.
Never, ever has any trouble. Has done nothing wrong. He's not had any ethical problems. He hasn't broken any laws. But he's in trouble this year. And Cook Political Report moved that race from solid Republican to lean Republican. Now, they made a point of saying that Barr is leading in the polls by 6 percentage points. But this is a district that Donald Trump won by something like 15 or 18 percentage points.
Right.
So what do you attribute the closeness of this race to? I don't even know who the Democrat is that's running against him.
I attribute it to economics. I attribute it to the fact that Trump hasn't really delivered on his promises, campaign promises of delivering jobs and economic opportunities in those areas. You have some people that may still stick with the Republican brand because they really dislike the Democrats that much. But I think that you see a chip in that lead based upon that they're hurting there. And now, just to add this real quickly, now that Trump has gotten this country involved in these tariff wars, and the blowback from that is actually going to hurt people in that area the hardest.
Right.
So I really believe that that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, I agree that I think it's a combination of stalled economic policies or economic policies that Trump has not delivered on, economic policies that have actually are turning on the very people who voted for Trump because he said that he would, you know, turn their economic fortunes around. And these continued problems with immigration. I don't think people like, even Republicans, I don't think that they like that Trump is basically holding families hostage to get funding for his wall. Mm-hmm. He's bribing people.
This is the cost of following Stephen Miller's advice.
This is exact. And I think people are not liking, even if they don't like our immigration policies, they don't like the way he is doing this. Optics are everything.
That's what really hurt him.
And having separating children from their parents, really bad optics. Even Trump admitted that. And even in solid, formerly safe red districts like Kentucky, I keep saying the Republicans have no answer for this. There's no answer for these kind of horrible optics.
And we're seeing the same kind of situation in Texas's 23rd district. I didn't put this on our list to talk about, but I want to talk about the 23rd. The 23rd is one of the largest. It is the largest congressional district in terms of square mileage in the state of Texas and one of the largest in America.
Mm-hmm.
It's represented by a friend of mine, Will Hurd. I was Will's mentor at the CIA. And when he said that he wanted to run for Congress, all of us urged him not to because we said it was a step down to go from the CIA to Congress. But he ran and he lost the first time. He lost the Republican primary the first time. He won the second time he ran and then won the general election, which is crazy because This is a Supreme Court mandated majority Hispanic district.
Wow.
Right? Hispanics had been gerrymandered out of representation.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court ruled that that was wrong. The Supreme Court created this district just to be represented by Hispanic. Will is an African-American Republican,
mm-hmm.
and he won the race.
Okay.
So he's never won more than 49%. There's always some minor candidate that jumps in as an independent that gets 3 or 4 or 5%. So Will has won twice, but by something like 47% and then 49%.
Yeah, not by big margins. Yeah.
So what he's done is he has gone as far to the left on immigration as any Republican can safely do. He announced this morning that he was going to oppose the Republican compromise bill on immigration, which I'll add hasn't actually even been written yet. But
wow.
Whatever it is, he's voting against
it. Right.
And it looks like that might be enough to save him. Now, in previous years, this has been the closest race in America. He has been the most endangered Republican in America. But now Cook is saying that it's likely Republican. So do you think that Will Hurd perhaps has found the solution to running as a Republican in this era of immigration crisis?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, you got a guy that's being, that's representing the district that has a large Hispanic population. That's just smart politics, out on the side of immigration that he has. But I also want to say this, in the Republican Party, and I hate to say that they're a monolithic group of people, sure. But at the same time, if you really look at it, most black Republicans are moderate. I don't know any really far right black Republicans, even though I don't support many of them policy wise. But I think that when most black Republicans get in power, they tend to be moderate.
Yeah. Yeah. Except for, the few that aren't relevant anymore, like the Herman Cain's and the.
Yeah, but they never held office.
But they never held office. So they're not. They don't represent the black contingent, if you want to call it, of the Republican Party. And I think you're absolutely right, Abdus. Most black Republicans do tend to lean moderate on many issues because, let's be honest, for most black people in this country, most of us, especially if we grew up in church, in anybody's church, we are socially conservative, whatever you want to encompass. And we tend to be more moderate on some other issues. So it's really hard to get black voters into the Republican Party because of the hard right stances. Mm-hmm. And black Republicans who are already in the party do have to walk that fine line to hold office. Mm-hmm. Because more likely than not, they're representing districts that are other people of color.
Yes.
That is smart politics, but that's also, I think, just the ideological makeup of your typical black Republican.
Well, before we leave Texas, I want to mention one other race. This is Texas's 32nd district. It's represented by Republican Pete Sessions. Pete Sessions is the son of the former FBI director, Sessions, I forget his first name now, but he's the guy that was fired by Bill Clinton
in the mid-1990s. Yeah, I remember him now.
Yeah. So he's always been very popular. He's quite conservative. The district is quite conservative. So he's always been reelected very easily. In fact, I think he got something in the 75% range last time. The Cook Political Report has moved his race to lean Republican, not likely Republican, not solid Republican, lean Republican. They attribute this, just like Abdus, we were talking about a second ago,
right,
to demographic changes
right
in Texas. Texas is turning more and more heavily Hispanic, and as a result is very slowly turning purple. And they make a point that once Texas does turn purple, there's a possibility that a Republican could never win the presidency again.
That explains the wall.
That explains the wall.
That is why, I don't like to get in conspiracy theories here, but I always believe that that's the reason why the Republican Party is so much for trying to stem these tide of immigration. Because it's not just about what they tell us, taking jobs and all this stuff. It's also about the change in demographics. This district and Sessions district, they voted for Hillary.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah. So and crazy. Then and now you're talking about a guy who really hasn't put on the boxing gloves since 2004.
No, they coast to re-election. True.
That's true.
Think about it.
You know, so now when it's like any prize fighter, you haven't put on the boxing gloves. And now when you get someone who's hungry and then the demographics are changing, what are you going to do?
Exactly. That's exactly what all of this anti-immigrant fervor is about. Among politicians.
And it's turning people off. Steve Smith, who was John McCain's national campaign manager in the 2008 presidential campaign, became a Democrat yesterday.
Wow.
And announced that the Republican Party had moved so far to the right that in good conscience, he couldn't call himself a Republican anymore. I think that that's actually not unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And if we actually do see Texas turn purple, it would have to be a fluke of a year where a Republican would have to do what Donald Trump did and win Pennsylvania, Ohio, mm-hmm. Michigan, mm-hmm. Wisconsin, Florida, North Carolina, et cetera, to win. Now, Steve Smith said yesterday that he believes the Republican Party is going to go the way of the Whig Party.
Wow.
That it's going to just go
that
away.
That is a major statement.
And that something more moderate is going to have to come out of the ashes.
Right, right.
I agree with this. And I don't agree with it just because I'm hoping that it happens to both parties, actually. But I agree with it because it makes sense, because the Republican Party can't have a worse image. I mean, they've got open white supremacists mm-hmm. running in and running unopposed.
Yes.
In some smaller state races.
Sure.
I mean, they've taken this hard line against immigration, where historically this country didn't even have federal immigration laws until 1975. I mean, everybody else who came here, with the exception of the descendants of African slaves, were undocumented people.
Right.
So we understand from a political standpoint that all of this is about keeping and maintaining political power. But I think more people who are supporters of both parties are waking up to the fact that immigrants aren't the problem. It's corporations. It's the people who are funding these politicians. These are the people who are denying job opportunities to Americans. And people are slowly starting to wake up to this false message that these politicians are feeding people,
yeah.
that it's the brown people coming over the border, it's the black people here. No, it's the corporations who are screwing us over.
I agree.
We're going to have to end it there. Unfortunately, we were joined in the studio by Jacqueline and Abdus Lukman. They're the co-editors-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their very interesting live stream every Thursday night at 9 o'clock p.m. on Facebook.
YouTube now.
And YouTube.
Yes.
That's fantastic. Check out YouTube, too. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.